Hello, this is Beth Maples Bays, and this is Lesbian Echoes, a podcast about older lesbians from America and beyond. We hope you enjoy our podcast and listening to the stories of lesbians worldwide. Hello, and welcome to Lesbian Echoes. Today we have with us Joy Bright. Hi, Joy.
Hey, good to see you, Beth.
Good to see you, too. You are well known in lesbian feminist circles, but there are probably many of our listeners who don't know anything about you. So we'll just start at the same beginning we always start with, and that is, how old are you?
66 physically, but going on about 15 emotionally. Oh. No. I'm still riding a skateboard, I always say.
Well, okay. So how old were you when you came out?
In 1971, I was 16 years old, and I was in high school. And I had heard about, or rather read about, I think it was a free weekly. It might have been an LA weekly. I'm in California. And I was in the San Diego area when I was 16 years old. But I originally came from LA. And I used to keep up with the information that was going on in Los Angeles. I had a very liberal mindset. And I was always looking to see what was going on with plays and movies and looking for anything that was alternative culture kind of stuff. Somewhere I saw, and I don't remember exactly, but about Daughters of Bilitis. And I was looking and seeking so desperately for something where there were other women that I felt like me, because I had way too many actresses that I had had crushes on since I was a little kid. And I knew that lesbians existed. I just couldn't figure it out. And I wrote a letter. There was an address for Daughters of Bilitis, and it was in LA, and I was, 2 hours south. And one of the women from Daughters of Bilitis replied to my letter very kindly. I had asked if there was anybody I could meet in the San Diego area, and they sent me a name, I think, and a phone number of a woman who was probably in her 40s, and she was very kind. I reached out to her, and I attended a meeting where there were about six or seven women that were all in their 40s, and me with 16 years old, long hair. I thought that I should dress up. So I had a sundress on or something. And I never wore dresses except for some sort of occasion that I thought I should present myself in some way. I was a little butch that just didn't know, a little tomboy, just didn't know. And I showed up to this meeting, and these gals, looking back, and later one of them told me that I was such a cute, kid, and they saw a very old person in that cute little kid, very mature in a certain way. And they couldn't believe I was 16 years old. And also I understood their concern too, because I was underage, but I was driving a car. I, snuck over there. I had lied to my parents about going to the beach or something, or going to visit a friend. And, a lot of kids in California learn to drive early. And this is back, like I said, in 71. And I made kind of friends with a couple of women, but they were very cautious. They kept me at a, nice kind of arm's length. But they also kind of took me in the same time, showed me some ropes. And one of them told me, don't ever worry about dressing like you normally want to dress, because that's more who you are. And they could tell that. So anyway, long story description there, but 16 and in 1971, while I was in high school, in love with my best friend, and she didn't know it.
Well, you were young, weren't you?
Yeah.
I didn't come out till I was 26, but I had sex with a girl when I was 15. Anyway, so tell me your lesbian life story.
My lesbian life story is not that separate from just, I would have to say it informs everything. Everything. Well, I've heard a lot of women talk about their lives. It seems like they, in general, a lot of women seem to compartmentalize being a lesbian, separate from political work, separate from other kinds of activism. And what I have found as being both in coupled situations for much of my life, and being a single lesbian for much of my life as well, there's a sadness to be about most of the lesbians that I've met seem to only want to define themselves as lesbians when they are in a couple, as if that's the thing that validates, you know, this idea that, you know, that old phrase, practicing homosexual.
Yes.
I've often made fun of that, and I've told people I have always been a practicing homosexual. That doesn't mean you have to be actively engaged in a romantic or sexual encounters with other same-sex partners, right? And that kind of mentality that I have about being a lesbian, like I said, it has informed every cell in my body. Every friendship that I've had with men or women, every business interaction, pretty much every job, everything that I've done, the choices that I've made in life have been akin, hand in hand, with the fact that I am a lesbian. And as I brought up about being 16 years old, and at that particular time, I had really long hair, to have these older lesbians look at me and really see that I was a tomboy, that I was a butch, and have that something that was validated in a way that was so intrinsic. I realized no matter how I was presenting myself in the more stereotyped in a way femininity, although I never ever did any makeup when I went to that meeting or anything else subsequent, I realized it really was that thing called gaydar that we used to talk about. That connection with other women, you know, when you see somebody walk in a room, when you can see the agency that a woman, how she holds herself, that quite often, at least the generation that I've come from, I can see that in a woman. I can see in some straight women, the way that they hold themselves, that they are powerful, that they have that agency. And for me, I can usually, at least I can guess, I might be wrong, but I can guess if a woman that walks in the room or is in a crowd or something, if I can make eye contact and watch her, I often know. And I don't know what it is exactly, except that being keenly aware of survival as a young lesbian, as a young girl before I realized about lesbianism, I have always studied how, quote, normal heterosexual people, what their expectations are, what makes them feel comfortable, how I was supposed to act, and how I could try to not get hurt or hospitalized for mental illness or whatever, because that was, again, the generation I came from. I thought that I was going to be in a mental institution with probes on my head or something like that, you know, films like The Snake Pit with Eleanor Parker, I worried that I would be, you know, put in some institution or something for the thoughts that I had. From a very early age, I can remember from age 3 to 5. And I've only had that validated because of my parents telling me, oh yeah, you know, you did this or that. So how old was I? Oh, geez, that was 1958. Well, I was 3 years old. And I went, oh my God. When my mom told me that I was staring at an actress on the screen who was wearing a particular dress, you know, and things like that, they're not just these cognitive memories, but it's something that's kind of in me. That stuff has never left. It's never left. So I feel like it has informed everything, as I said, Beth.
Well, I do know this much about you. I know that you lived in the San Francisco area early in your life.
No, I'm there now. I'm in Oakland, California.
Oh, okay.
For the last 30 plus years. I was in Southern California the early part of my life.
Oh, okay. Well, tell me about living in Southern California as a lesbian.
Very difficult. Coming out in 71, Ms. Magazine had just come out. Ms. Magazine, I begged them at the high school to get it in the library. They eventually did, I think. And Ms. Magazine was something that helped me to start looking at feminism, because my lesbianism never had anything to do, I didn't think, with this thing called feminism. You know, I knew I wanted to be with women. I didn't want to be with women who had hairy legs. That was just me. This is a kid that, like I said, I had attraction to many actresses, and Sophia Loren and Eleanor Parker and, you know, whatnot. Those were my ideal women. And growing up in Southern California, at that time, well, I did start becoming politicized at an early age. My parents were Democrats. I was one of those always looking at social justice issues. How could anybody that was being trampled on be helped up? You know, raise a hand. My mom taught me that from a very young age. She never used the word activism, but I was doing all that stuff. And a lot of the politics at that time were very polarized, but I was surrounded by a lot of democratic, if you will, from the party at the time, values, and very progressive social values. But everything in popular culture, as you well know, you know, it was extremely heterosexual and a forced kind of heteronormativity existed with every breath. You know, when you'd wake up every day as a little kid who had these same sex thoughts and all that. But Southern California provided a little tomboy with these options of sports. And I, physically able-bodied and very lucky and very aware of my privilege in that way, I want to say the advantages that I had, and that I had a lot of speed, very agile. I was doing gymnastics and playing different sports. But I got into skateboarding at an early age, and I had an uncle who really respected my tomboyishness, and he started teaching me how to ride and drive, because riding is one thing and driving is another thing, right? Learning to be a good rider first before you take your hands and put them on a wheel of a car or a motorcycle. And I had an uncle that was not a blood relative, but he took a real affection to me and taught me how to get on a mini bike when I was 8 years old, how to get into a go-kart when I was 8 years old at the same time. So I had a love of cars, a love of speed, and a love of having control over something, because I felt so much lack of control, you know, with the options in 1963, in 1963, when I was 8 years old, I felt very few options about growing up and becoming a woman. It terrified me. I thought that I would grow up to be a man, that somehow some miracle or something was going to happen and I would become a man so I could do all these other things. I never wanted children. I didn't want to be with a man. I knew that. And I didn't want to be a secretary. I didn't want to be a teacher. My parents were both teachers. And guess what I became later? But anyway, that's another story. Not formally educated as a teacher, but I did. But all these things, what did we have? Secretary, right? I didn't even type. I still have never learned how to type. Huh. I type with one finger and I do it really fast.
Nursing.
Nursing was another one. Yes. Secretary, nurse. What else? Some sort of caregiver or something like that. I mean, there were very few options, again, besides being a teacher. And I didn't want to do any of that. I wanted to work with my hands. I wanted to change things. I felt literally from the ground up. Or also, I felt like I had a mind of an artist, but I wasn't sure what that meant. And I was always drawing. I did cartooning and sold drawings when I was a little kid. So that was going on, but I didn't know what was going to happen or if I would even survive. And you know, Beth, for the longest time, I thought I would be dead by the time I was 20 because I had all these feelings. And when I hit 20, I went, oh, well, I made it here. Maybe it's not going to happen until I'm 25. And you know, that happened to me, and that feeling, until I was 40 years old. I thought for sure that some man was going to shoot me and kill me, either dating a woman or just being out in life. In the career that I had long time as a house painter, which I actually still do. So lesbian life. I forget where the original question went with this, but you said life in Southern California did afford me a lot of sports, a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of ability to have an excuse for being a tomboy, because sports was something where they could accept sometimes a girl being a fast runner, playing softball. You know, it was seen as kind of cute, but I knew I could never have a career in anything like that. Now, if I was a little girl and these skate parks that exist now, oh, I probably would have had a busted leg by now and had a whole bunch of fun, you know, and be spinning up in the air and all that stuff in a skate park. But anyway, it was the weather was always nice when it wasn't too hot. And my dad insisted every summer we went to the beach. We would drive about an hour or so and go to the beach. And I was one of those kids that was in the sun a lot and in the ocean a lot. And I learned how to swim at a very young age, thanks to my mother. So I had a pretty good childhood with, we didn't have much money. And of course there were, you know, family issues and things like that. My parents never divorced. They probably should have at some point, but I was surrounded with a lot of love and battles with my father most constantly. A lot of girls I know, I've shared stories with other women my age that had these ongoing verbal and physical battles with their parents, with their fathers particularly. And I had such a battle with my dad all the time. Remember spanking, how that was the big acceptable way to treat your children? Yeah. Whether they said no or not to you, whether they just looked at you a particular way, there was that threat.
Yes.
Yeah.
How well I know.
Yep. So I was one of those.
Did you have siblings? And if so, what was your birth order?
Yes, I was a second daughter only I had a sister that was 6 years older than I was, which my parents always let me know how much they regretted that they waited so long to have a second child. And my sister and I had an extremely contentious relationship. I was always trying to seek her acceptance and her attention and her affection as a sister, but she was too old, and I was annoying. And she had been the firstborn and the one that had all the attention, extremely feminine. And this little weird child came out and who wanted her to try to play with me and play in the mud. And I did all of these typical things. I was into slot cars and all this stuff. And my sister and I had a very, very difficult time until I came out. And she was the first person that I came out to at 16. And from then on, she and I had a very strong relationship. She had grown up more. She understood then all the times that she had been really mean to me and what I was going through. And so we had a whole new relationship really from that time on. She was very supportive,
Have to say, I envied you having a sister. I was the eldest. If you put his and hers and theirs together, I was the eldest of seven and the only girl.
Mm.
So I had six kid brothers. I wound up in the mud with them and playing baseball, not softball, with them and G.I. Joe. And I had my Barbies, but I always had to play with their G.I. Joes too. They were my brothers, and I just, because I was raised in the South, I felt like I was responsible because I was a girl and I was older than them. So, but we're not here to talk about me.
It's interesting, though, the intertwining of, and you brought that up about birth order, because I really do, you know, later studying a lot of psychology and looking at birth orders of children, and especially two same-sex children, you know, and having my mother having the two daughters. It very much, my sister was the one that was compliant. She was the daddy's girl. She was extremely feminine. She started growing her nails, I think, when she was like 12, you know, filing, and she had these long nails. And I was absolutely the opposite. And she told me, you know, as adults, when we talked about this, she said, when I popped out, she thought I was like her little brother. And I asked her, well, I mean, I was a baby. I said, what are you talking about? She said, just everything about you. And the way that she noticed the way that I looked at other girls at a very young age. I mean, I wanted to get married to another girl when I was, you know, like I said, 3 and specifically 5 years old. As soon as I got socialized late at 5 years old in kindergarten, my mother didn't really have me around other kids. And the moment I was around other girls, I guess it was just, I did some stupid staring for a little bit too long. My sister saw this stuff. She thought I was a freak. So as an adult, she apologized to me later because she used to beat me up.
Oh.
She used to slap me around. She sat on me to try to. And I was very skinny. I was very skinny, agile, athletic. My sister was heavier. And Yeah, she kind of tortured me. So it was really interesting, you know, as adults having conversations about this idea of, you know, we used to talk about homosexuality. Is it nature or nurture? And, you know, very, very interesting, because I wouldn't have known. My mother didn't tell me anything until later also about feeling like I was really a boy. I mean, they gave me very much the implications that I was really supposed to be, air quote, a boy. So I got that message from early on. And the birth order is, from what I understand, again, psychologically, a lot of times, not 100%, many times that older child wants to be the good one, wants to obey, and wants to make sure they have their father's and mother's approval, whatever. And I was the rebel. And the second child is often the rebel. And, you know, with I would say the underlying violence that was in my home, which came from my father mostly, that I thought of the two of us, that I was the child that got spanked. I never saw my sister get spanked. I did see my father ridicule her in a particular way, usually happened around the dinner table, and it was about her weight. And it made me very angry, but I couldn't fight back much at all at that point without being punished physically. And I did get punished that way. Now, as an adult, I learned from my sister, when we talked about the violence and the acceptance of that generation to punish their children always with the threat of physical violence, you know, which I would say, I'm saying physical violence. And for anybody that's younger, if you use the word spanking, a lot of people think, oh, that's a couple whacks on the butt or something. no, it is for some people. They're lucky if they can escape that. Mine was a little closer to what Bill Cosby used to make fun of in the records that we heard when Bill Cosby talked about having a father who used to point to a closet where he threatened that there was some like 8-foot belt or something, you know, and it was a joke back at the time. But now my dad had a belt. And anyway, my sister said to me when I was bringing up some of the resentments and the pain that I had from my childhood about that, she said, well, hold on. Do you think you're the only one that got spanked? And I was shocked. And she then revealed through anger and tears to me, you know, she was around for 6 years before I came along. And I had no idea. And it was the first time that she revealed to me how, and it made sense. This was a very angry man who had come from poverty and worked his way up through getting a teaching credential. And that was a big deal. You know, it was a very big deal in the mid 60s for a man to become an elementary school teacher. Also, he wanted to teach the lower grades. And that was a big achievement at the time. I didn't appreciate that for many, many years, but my sister, yeah, she became his, you know, punching bag before I did. So she said she was relieved when I came along in that way.
I'll bet.
And therein lies the contention a lot that we had with each other, because I had no idea that she got kind of a break, you know? Mm-hmm. And that wasn't something that a 6-year-old girl is going to, well, even at 10 years old or whatever, even when I was 5 years old and she was, what, you know, 11, she's not going to share that with me. She had to wait till I was around 20. And, you know, and then we could talk about some stuff. And so, yep, so much for birth order and sisters. I always wanted a little brother, and I begged my mother to have another child, and she said, hell no.
I always wanted my mother to have a sister, and everyone that came along was a boy. I was so disappointed the last one, because she had told me it was going to be the last one. She was going to have a tubal ligation. And
wow.
I cried. In my piano lesson. My piano teacher was so sweet. Well, let's move on up to, let's say, young adulthood. Let's go to the lesbian bars.
Ooh, that was some big fun. It was frightening at first, because after I came out like that at 16, then it was like, okay, I know there's other women now. What am I going to do? Well, you know, I'm 16 years old. I'm in high school. And I mean, lesbian bars are a ways off, but I got very bold. And I was liked enough as kind of one of the oddballs at the school. But now I was really about to become a real oddball. And there were a couple of gals at that school that were popular. And there was one gal who wasn't popular, and she was kind of known as the pothead, I guess, at the school at the time. But three different girls, I went up to them and I asked them out on a date. And you know what? The two most popular girls that I had asked out, I clearly had thought about it a lot and checked them out enough to think that they weren't going to turn on me. And neither of them did. They were both surprised. And I can remember their reactions like yesterday, because I really worked up to it. And they told me they were flattered, but they weren't going to do that, and wished me well. And, you know, could we still be friends? And I said, absolutely. And I was the jokester, so I had that going on. And then this gal that was kind of the druggy in a way, because she just smoked a lot of pot. I think she might have been dealing some weed at the high school. And she was fine with me too. She said, you know, I'm not into that. I didn't know what that was yet, because I hadn't done anything. but she said, I'm not into that. And but, you know, wished me well. And they all stayed, you know, friendly with me. All three of those gals, they did not distance themselves from me, although one of them got a couple of the boys made fun of me, and they defended me at the lockers. And that was a big deal. That was a big deal. But I just kind of went, you know, I can't pretend. I just can't pretend. And so feminism was something that I started to adopt. I started to read some literature that I could get a hold of and learn about things. Most of it was coming from the East Coast. By the time I was 20, so 4 years into that, and I came out to a girl that I was just madly in love with. She was my best friend. She came around too. We were lovers, and both got same age, and I got a fake ID at 20 and went to the local, and it was called a gay bar. I mean, that there was no lesbian bar. They didn't talk about them like that. Gay was predominantly men. You had, like, you know, 90% men and maybe 10%, if that, of women would go into these bars. And I wanted to dance. I wanted to meet. I was never a drinker, but that was the painful thing, was going into the bars and experiencing how many women absolutely wanted to meet each other, but were doing it through a haze, through a dulled mind. And I wanted to have conversations. I wanted to talk about, how are women going to get better in the world? How are we going to get more power? Because it couldn't possibly be that all these eons had gone by And here we were, you know, in the 70s. What the heck was going on, you know? 1975. How could we not do better? And there were a lot of drunks, and I knew a lot of these women that were drunks, and I became a designated driver, you know, once I got of age and all that. And even before I was of age, like I said, I wasn't supposed to be going to the bars. But one funny thing that did happen, funny and sad, is that the second time I went to a gay bar and I sat and I observed a lot, my former gym teacher from high school, who was such a dyke, she was like truck driver kind of, okay? She was like what Meg Christian would sing about, the gym teacher. And you know that she was a fallout alcoholic, full-blown, of course, older woman than I was, sitting there at the bar. I recognized her right away. And I went up to her and she recognized me, and she wasn't teaching gym anymore. I don't know what had happened to her, but she put her arm very carefully on my shoulder, you know, and sort of tapped me. She didn't touch me any more than that. Her name was Mrs. Kimball. And that was the thing, was that the Mrs. had to be there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that she was married to a gay man. They were each other's cover, right? Or what we call a beard for each other. And Mrs. Kimball and I said, Mrs. Kimball, do you need a ride home? And she thanked me in a very slurred voice. And she said, you know, you were always one of those little shiners. I know that. And she laughed. And I said, a little shiner. And she said, I knew you'd shine someday. You still got it in you, you know. And it was like this drunken, I was like, oh my God, Mrs. Kimball. But Mrs. Kimball was kind of a perv. And I remembered that. And it's something now that in my 60s, if I could talk to her, it'd be very interesting. The conversation would be very different. But there I was, only 20. And she knew I was underage and in the bar. And everybody had to be very careful because there were still busts that would go on. The police would still show up to these bars. And I couldn't stay for very long. And, you know, luck of the draw, there wasn't a bust while I was there, but the bar was busted several times. And I knew other lesbians that had gotten busted. And some of them spent the night in jail and had very harsh consequences as a result. So I was risking all that stuff. And, you know, by the following year in 76, I knew a lot of lesbians at that point. And I had had more than a couple of lovers. And life just changed. But the bars became something that was very important for me. Again, more as a social thing for me. I was pretty, you know, clean and sober. But there were other lesbians that I knew at the time that had killed themselves, just drunk themselves into car accidents and motorcycle accidents and
liver failure.
Well, yeah, they were these that I knew. I mean, we were around the same age, and they didn't.
They hadn't gotten there yet.
Actually, alcohol toxicity, I remembered one. It was the first time I had ever heard that. And that was interesting. But yeah, the pains of watching women, mostly. I didn't care to get involved with gay men in particular. I didn't see that they, you know, except for knowing that if the man, like the cops, came after us as a group, I would always have their backs, and I had. And the gay men who were very effeminate, I was always more friendly, you know, with them, and I felt protective of very effeminate gay men that just seemed like they could not help themselves. Like I couldn't help myself being as masculine as I was. Mm-hmm. Those were the days. I mean, there's that kind of life that once you live that, goes back to what I was talking about, having a kind of survival mode that most straight people, unless they are not white or unless they are othered in some other way, or they are disabled visibly that other people are going to treat them shitty, there's a way that coming from that gives you a radar that most people that are comfortable, that are physically able-bodied, that, you know, have money. There are a lot of things that can create a kind of privilege that make you feel not having the need to sort of look around your shoulder all the time. And all of those things informed who and how I began dating and finding lovers and all of that. Those skills, those survival skills, you know?
Well, let's move forward a little bit to your activism. When did that start and how did it start?
So I said, when I was a child, although my mother never used the word activism, what I got was a real sense that once I understood that through learning about the Holocaust, and although I'm not Jewish, I knew that there were millions of Jews and people that were called dissidents and outliers and anybody that objected to certain governments and things like that, that were rounded up, you know, and this happened in the name of whatever. I knew for sure that I didn't believe in any God. So I was an atheist from the time that I had a consciousness about an idea of some omnipotent being. I didn't believe in it. And because I was a film lover from the time I was a very small child, I saw lots of documentaries. I always watched the reels at the movie theater. I wanted to make sure to get there early to watch newsreels and things like that. Anything that involved the oppression of people, the rounding up of individuals, the actual jailing and or slaughter of people, the McCarthy era, when I was born and learning about the McCarthyism, learning about the Holocaust of the Jews and the dissidents of that time, I decided at a very young age, and I'm talking again, something around eight years old, that I was going to use my life to try to help people. My mother started taking me out with her, and almost every Saturday for a good period of my life, and it was not a religious household that I grew up in at all. They were pretty just agnostic, my parents. My mom took me out and we collected money for muscular dystrophy. And I learned what it was like to go door to door and talk to strangers. And when you think about back in the day like that, the people literally, my mom had a particular container. There were receipts that were written out for people. And we did that for a couple, 3 hours. You know, we do that for a long time. And so even though I was terrified to do any speaking in front of my class or anything at school, I didn't learn how to really stand in front of people and speak till I was in my 20s, late 20s. I learned how to talk to people open when they would open their doors. I learned how to open my mouth. My mother did, you know, most of the talking, but there I was, you know, this little kid, and they thought that was cute. And they donate more money for muscular dystrophy. So I would say my activism started around my knowledge of worldly things. Like I said, the McCarthy era and World War II really helped inform my activism. And I was at that age, when President Kennedy was shot, and that wave of grief that ran over the adults in my life, that was another thing that sealed me to be a Democrat. This idea that, you know, all the idealism and all, a lot of bullshit, I mean, that we were fed, but this idealism of democracy, of fairness, of all of that. I thought that Kennedy, you know, embodied. My parents were very, very much against any kind of racism. At the time, the word wasn't racism that was used, it was prejudice.
Yes.
My parents taught me not to be prejudiced, you know, which was interesting. You think about that word now. And in the area that I grew up, I had a lot, most of my friends were Mexicans. This is Los Angeles. This is the city, you know, this is the early mid 60s. All my friends pretty much were Mexicans. And I had some very dark skinned Mexican friends, and they were always treated badly, worse than the lighter skinned Mexicans. And I was what they used to call a half breed. I have to bring that up as well, because it's something that just as much as my lesbianism has helped to inform this idea of looking around me all the time and survivalism. And that is that my father was very white, you know, not just Caucasian, but I mean, he grew up in a very white and racist home with his two parents, who were just very, very ignorant white people. One from Texas, one from Oklahoma. My dad was the kid that popped out and said, "No, I'm not going to believe like you do," he said to his parents. And my father married a woman from South America, Argentina. For him, she was exotic. My mother's very Caucasian. She's just a very light-skinned Latina woman. And they got married and they produced these two children, my sister and I, as I spoke of earlier. But my sister and I were growing up in a household where Spanish was spoken and English was spoken. And when I was, you know, very young, my mother's mother came from Argentina and helped to raise me. And I was a beloved granddaughter for her. And that helped to inform all of my stuff about women too, and options in the world and jobs and how women are caretakers and the love of a grandmother who would protect me as much as she could.
So you had a Latina.
So the activism, I'm sorry, Beth, that's where I think the activism started, was it was the confluence of all that stuff.
Yeah. I was just going to say, you had a Latina grandmother and you're basically Caucasian. I mean,
yes.
To look at you. And I am Caucasian and my grandson is Mexican, dark skinned Mexican. So it's the opposite. But he doesn't know anything about, well, we're teaching him, but he was not. We got him when he was 2 days old, so he didn't know anything but us. But I'm sorry, I interrupted again. I do it all the time.
Not at all. It's just a conversation. It's interesting about this idea of interruption. I want to say, having conversations with a lot of people too, and interviewing people, you know, mm-hmm. The exchanges and how I learned to communicate a lot, I would say, with other women, but with other lesbians. And I got some really great exchanges in my mid to late 20s, meeting women from back east, a lot of Jewish women, a lot of Catholic women too, that had very academic backgrounds. You know, the Jewish women that I met that were very much into the mind and social justice issues as well, that helped to inform the way that I began to converse, the love of language, and what Studs Terkel, I always remember, who really helped to, I got to say, inform my activism as I was an older person, to the idea of storytelling and real conversing. For me, the most comfortable I'm with are what a lot of people consider interruption. And I find that mostly with people who come from Judeo-Christian backgrounds. And I call it banter. You know, for me, interruption is, it's a whole other thing than having a speed and a banter with each other, where it's like you get two minds together and boom, if you're really on fire, there's nothing like it. And there's certain topics that people can get really behind, you know, if you're enjoying a subject together. So I didn't see what you just did as any form of interruption.
Well, thank you. I was raised in Southern Appalachia. So, you know, manners are very important. I've tried to get beyond manners, but I'm not always successful.
But those manners are based, this idea of a manner is based on a value that is from your culture, right?
Yes.
And from the culture that I started learning about with my, particularly my friends that I started meeting that were East Coasters, there was a pace, a speed, and more of a freedom, I felt, to begin to talk over somebody, but learn when to back up, or the fact if they could come back, you know, there's more like this idea of bantering where you go back and forth. For me, that's where the seeds of ideas start happening, in a disagreement or in real agreement with something and bringing up examples. And you might start to go on top of somebody and then apologize a little bit, maybe back off, but they say, no, it's okay. Let's take it from there. And you just keep it going. But that's about chemistry, right? And sometimes that takes time.
Yes.
And we have to back off a little more. And some of that backing off, it may come from the values that you've learned. I'm not from the South. But this idea now of just slowing down maybe a little, listening better, looking at body language if you have that opportunity, or if you're just on the telephone and you're not looking at the person. I think that stuff just more comes with age and practice and getting slapped upside the head sometimes too verbally, and somebody saying, stop interrupting me. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm so excited.
Well, let's talk about your adult activism. Your lesbian feminist activism.
A lesbian feminist activism is not something I would identify right now in the recent past that I've been doing, but I certainly had a long time of lesbian activism, and what that involved, I'll back up a bit, Beth, to not right now, but has to do with so much the music industry, arts, and how women began communicating with each other through writing articles, books, you know, things like that. In the music scene, I would say in particular, I started to learn how to become a producer when I realized there were not enough concerts happening. They weren't playing the voices of women on the radio. I mean, what we had, Melissa Etheridge, the moment I heard Melissa Etheridge's voice, I had no idea who she was, but I heard the lyrics to the one song and I said, that woman must be a lesbian. Gotta be a lesbian.
She is.
And, you know, this comes from performing at the third annual, this new women's music festival called the Michigan Women's Music Festival. I mean, I started performing I'll skip over a lot of that, but you know, late 20s, I was producing and performing in music festivals and at women's coffee houses and all of that, separate from the bar scene, all the cultural things that started to happen in the 70s that we were building, right? Women's bookstores, all that. I had a musical partner. We were like a female version of Simon and Garfunkel, if you will, Lennon McCartney. She was left-handed, I was right-handed. I always remember Paul and John talking about writing songs in an airplane, you know, with their, it was like a circle between them, the left-handed one, the right-handed one. I was with a partner like that for a number of years, wrote a lot of music. Moving.
And I wish I had known you then.
I wish I'd known a lot of women at that time. I mean, I did, but you know, again, that was back in when lesbian connection, when you would argue with somebody about something, you'd have to write a response to a printed thing that you got in the mail. And then you'd write either thank yous or editorials or whatever, literally type that out or handwrite it out and then put it in the mail and send it to Lesbian Connection. And maybe your response would come out. So it was almost a month after the other person had already written their thing, right? What did that give us? Something now that is lost with Facebook and Twitter and everything? The basic thing of patience. Patience, right?
Yeah.
You could have a million assumptions go on in your mind about whether or not that woman was going to respond in a particular way. And telephone calls were very expensive out of the state. Remember that? My God.
Out of my reach.
Out of my reach. Very working class here. And yeah, getting on a telephone. And then of course with telephones too, think about that. You often had only one phone in the house. If you had a second phone in the house, you had a lot more money. And then, you know, until things became cheaper, this is pre-answering machines. I mean, I could go through why I think all of those realms of tech and communication that existed helped to inform how we have relationships. And now with the idea of Facebook and having fights or sparks of interest or developing any kind of intimacy or distancing with each other, everything is like pop, pop, pop. Instant. Women want everything immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I demand eye contact. I demand that we have voice to voice. You know, if you're going to have this idea of better communication. So you asked me about lesbian and feminism together in my activism. And I have to mention that I was a lesbian separatist and very involved in lesbian separatism for a big chunk of years. And I won't go into all of that, but that's, you know, even separate from lesbian feminism and activism, much of my growth came out of being a lesbian separatist, where I really was trying to build that and live that. And I did for a number of years, but there's always been, going back to that Democratic, the very straight, you know, Democratic Party, there's always been working in that realm, having a foot in that, as well as a separate world of lesbian feminism and activism.
But lesbian separatism is what gave birth to me in 1978. Absolutely. I was so blessed and fortunate to come out in that context, and with all the support from the women. I was in Missoula, Montana, little bitty place, but service hub for Five Valleys. So there was a lot more there than you would think there would be, knowing that it was only 32,000 people.
Wow.
We had Westcoast entertainment, and I got to see Meg within 3 or 4 months of coming out. It was heaven. And those were the women who guided me, showed me, read this, read Daily, read Dworkin, read Susan Brown Miller, Amazon Expedition, I, you know, that's my heart, mm-hmm. because I didn't get to have it long.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead. I just had to say that because that's my heart.
Yeah. In 1978, when the Michigan Women's Music Festival was, just like I said, its third year, and to be selected to be on the stage of that, and the idea of performing like I did with my partner at the time in our original music too, there's nothing like doing that. And the difference between performing in small coffee houses with 50 women, maybe, where they were just, I mean, that was it. Everybody was starving for validation and also direction. Like, where are we going? It was always like, what are we going to do with this? I mean, we know we love women, but, you know, what are we doing here and building things? To be a performer in a coffee house where you can make eye contact throughout your songs and afterwards talk to women, to a place where I had 2,000 staring at me from a field and the sun going down at the same time. Yeah, that was quite something, 1978. But in 1975, 3 years before that, and when I was 20, going back a little bit, I got involved with a collective, which I never wanted to do again, and I never have. 13 of us, we did something that has never been replicated. It's the only time it's ever happened. And again, going back to San Diego, I was involved with 12 other women, all lesbians, but there was a split with us in that there were socialists and there were separatists. So lesbian separatists, we were the minority. There were four of us, and the rest, you know, were these lesbian socialists. But we made a pact to create a music festival. And in 1975 was San Diego's only ever women's music festival. You brought up Holly in the Air. It was funny. And back in those days, I learned that when events got produced and whatnot, you did a pay what you can. You would have a suggested amount, but pay what you can. And can you imagine now looking at going to a music festival?
No.
But with a suggested donation of $5,
wow.
You get there Friday night and you stay through Sunday night. Be gone by Monday morning. Be gone by Monday morning, right? Building the stage, everything. We did that, and it only got captured, only parts of that, on black and white videotape. Used to be half inch reel to reel by a woman named Eileen Griffin, and Eileen Griffin's footage and everything never saw the light of day. I got to see it in her studio. She was going to be turning that into a film, and her entire studio in San Diego, where she had erotica, lesbian erotica, and all this other stuff, that's a whole other life as well that I had. It got burned down. Her studio got burned down in San Diego. So the only footage, really, there's some pictures and whatnot. And I've thought about going back into Facebook, and I want to see if any women are still around that have negatives, because that's what you had to have at the time, right? In 1975, negatives from that San Diego Women's Music Festival. Bebe Kuroch, Meg Christian, Holly Near. Holly Near had just... That's where she fell in love, her and Meg, and that's where the breakup started to happen, right? With Meg and Jenny Burson. I know her here in Berkeley, ended up working with her later at the People's Radio Station here in Berkeley, years later. Anyway.
Thank you for doing that. Thank you so much. You laid the groundwork for the wave that reached me. In Montana, I went to a women's festival in 1979 in Montana, the Montana Women's Music Festival. I think it's the first and last one. Robin Tyler was there, Robin Flowers and Friends. I can't remember who else. there weren't a lot of big names, but there was a lot of talent.
Oh, tons. Yeah. Tons of talent.
Yeah.
Here in the Bay Area, a lot of that talent came out and they are here now, you know, where I've been. And it's funny because I'm not, you know, super friendly with any of the women, but I mean, between Holly Near living, you know, around the area, you remember Margie Adam?
Yes.
You know, I ended up on the dance floor with her a few years, you know.
Really?
Well, here in the Bay Area, when I moved from Southern California, I went to live for one solid year in Portland, Oregon, which was one of the most painful from a Southern California, you know, tomboy life to cold, damp, beautiful greenery everywhere. But I'd never been in such a sad location for a year. You know, I think I got to wear shorts one day. You know, this was back in 1979 while you were enjoying your thing. I was in Portland, Oregon for a year teaching women's self-defense classes. And I did that for 5 years. And that was part of my lesbian feminism, if you want to say, being a self-defense teacher. And pretty much for me, that when I was a separatist, lesbian separatist, and when I left that particular life, I still carry it, and it informs a lot of how I still am today about always kind of having an eyebrow up when someone says that they are a separatist or this or that. I'm like, yeah, no, it's usually not what's happening at all. A lot of the things that came out of that, and thank you for that acknowledgement. And I have other women, you know, before me, of course, to thank for even getting to the point that we were able to get to. Now there are some young women who I'm glad are looking back on some of that. They're trying to retrieve some of that. And that's where I would say some of my lesbian feminism is happening in my mentoring and some private relationships that I've been building with younger lesbians about this. But where all of my activism, Beth, has been of late and for the past few years is trying to give as much kickback as I can to the safeguarding of children,
yes,
the erasure of the female, the erasure of lesbians, which is where this gender ideology cult started, was in San Francisco. And my lesbian community, quick to follow along the whole West Coast, LA, up to Seattle, up to Vancouver in Canada. Somebody like Buck Angel, who I knew as Susan many years ago. I'm not saying we were friends. We were not. I knew this young lesbian who'd come from, I think, the LA area, if I'm not wrong in that, coming up to San Francisco. And, you know, showing her muscles and being involved in gay men's porn. And all of a sudden, this massive influx of money coming from I didn't know where, but I just knew that all of these young and similar age butch women like myself who were starting to take unregulated testosterone that was being handed out on the streets. I was targeted. My butch friends were targeted on the streets. I mentioned this in some YouTube interviews, you know, that happened last year with me, that we were targeted at the pop-up bars that started happening because lesbian bars all gone. We've seen this. When people talk like, I've heard some of the people you've had, the women, the lesbians on your other interviews, where some of them are really misinformed about what's going on with, quote, lesbian community. There is none. It pretty much exists online, unless there are those of us that have tight, little tiny groups and pairings that we do with our friends in real life. Of course, COVID has really kicked that in the ass, but I've lost literally to death my closest lesbians. Now, we used to look at each other. I lost a friend this past December, beautiful photographer, butch woman, Black radical activist named Len Keller. She started the Bay Area Lesbian Archives. And yes, she's a photographer and a filmmaker. And she was my closest compadre, as I like to say, we would look at each other and say, what the hell is going on? We knew this was something. Whenever we would try, either of us would try to talk about this with other lesbians, they always looked at us like we were just, they throw this word conspiracy theorist at both of us. And there are alive now only a couple of women that I can talk to locally that saw what happened in San Francisco, that really witnessed an entire dyke march of women become led in with the dykes on bikes, pressured to accept, first of all, they were lesbians. All they did was start taking a drug to change their secondary sex characteristics and maybe change their name to Mike or something, right? Sideburns, mustaches, little beards, you know, still have wide female hips, and yet want to be seen as what they used to call FTM, as in female to male. There was no trans man. That didn't happen until after the drug testosterone really got spread around a lot more. So I watched that community die, literally, as a, you know, man pretending to be a woman. Susan Stryker took on the academic, infiltrated the academic angle of San Francisco. Women's studies starts disappearing, gender studies. All of a sudden, the word gender just starts coming in. And the bars are gone by the, you know, 90s, mid-90s, they're gone. And, you know, for all the problems that we had in terms of dealing with each other a lot interpersonally, the lesbian relationships, the business relationships, the cultural arguments or whatever we would have, I watched a lot of those women of my age give birth to daughters that became the third waivers, that their whole thing became inclusivity. And now we know what inclusivity looks like. It's a man who's holding a woman's head down on the wrestling mat, choking her. That's what inclusivity looks like now.
Breaking her skull.
And these young, so-called new age, you know, feminists of third wave, literally cutting off their mothers, giving birth to children that they are putting puberty blockers in their bodies, wrong sex hormones. And I am working with a young lesbian who can't even come out that way, who's been studying this stuff, who understands tech and how big pharma have gotten into bed with each other to create and keep now this constant thing. So what am I doing with my quote lesbian feminism? What I'm doing with my activism is something I never thought I would do as a Democrat, as a progressive, all the things of social justice that we used to call that I supported. Black Lives Matter, when that popped out originally, I thought that that was a great idea.
Yeah.
I thought those values were good.
Yep.
To now learn that Black Lives Matter got captured almost immediately.
Yep.
I don't pay attention to anybody that has hashtag BLM or any of that stuff. You have to be very careful. A lot of people don't understand that is all a promotion of trans, which is a fictitious identity, just as these other identities. So while I do not have children, I'm living in that state that is doing the most damage, and the experiments started, except for Boston Children's in 2007 with their first quote, you know, pediatric gender clinic, to now be more than 300. I have been organizing and continue to organize protests around the country. I act kind of like a mission control at my laptop while I am building teams around the country. It is a very specific structure of protesting. As I was telling you off camera before you started recording, I am running protests with the long game in view. These are not the kinds of pussy hat rallies of, you know, women's rights. It's not the way that even anti-choice people stand in front of, you know, the Planned Parenthoods and protest, and they don't want abortion to be, you know, an option or anything. There are more the idea of women and men, of atheists like me and Christians and Jews, of non-believers of different faiths, of different backgrounds, different races, standing together in front of what I call these butcher shops, and more that my friend Alex Aaron, who reintroduced to me recently the phrase that kind of went click in my brain. Where did I hear that before? She said, sex role control centers, and something deep in me went boom. 1979, Janice Raymond and her book, The Transgender Empire.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
If anybody has not read that, read it now, because we are living it.
Yes, we are.
We are living it. And that's where my activism is. All of my activism is a way that is very funny to me, Beth, because again, being that Democrat, being that dyke used in a very positive way. And there are very few women that say that anymore. It used to, and it still is an epithet, I suppose. It's barely even recognized. Hardly anybody even knows the word dyke anymore. But to me, that's the lesbian rebel is the dyke. Dyke encompasses a politicization. It's an awareness about why we're in the position that we are. And with Janice Raymond saying that in the future there are going to be sex role control centers all over the place, they are here. They are here. And when I join hands with a Christian woman who may have thought that I was some evil homosexual even a few years ago, I've had these same women say to me, thank you, Joey. Thank you for introducing me to some ideas that used to scare me. Thank you for helping me to embrace my gay son, my lesbian daughter. I understand now that is a difficult choice, and that as a Christian, and of course I'm just reiterating this because I'm not a Christian, but I've had this said to me several times, so I'm just kind of, you know, mocking up a conversation here that I've had many times with particularly women and Christian men who have thanked me and said that they now embrace their gay son, their lesbian daughter, their gay grandchild, their lesbian grandchild, whatever. Because, you know, we look at each other and the thing that we agree on is there is no such thing as a human born in the wrong body. And if anybody knows
absolutely.
It's me. It's that little kid that had the nickname Joey many, many years ago. It's, you know, it's just my nickname. I have a very feminine legal name. I say that because I was always terrified that if I used my nickname, which I've been using now for years, but when I did start using it, I did get lesbians that said, oh, are you transing? Right away.
Yeah.
That's back in 2004. So this idea that I could be one of those kids, and most of my friends, and I'm talking my straight woman friends too, when they understand that there's an option for a 12-year-old girl to start taking puberty blockers, stop those periods from happening, get your breasts cut off, stop boys and men from staring at you, making you feel like you've got very few options in the world except to be a sex object or all those other little roles we were talking about earlier. That is what I'm fighting for now. And thank goodness I did work on the Obama campaign years ago now, because that taught me how to speak more and practice across the aisle, to Republicans and with people who are very religious, unlike me, people from very different backgrounds. I recruited a ton of people to vote for Obama at that time, and only to wonder and regret now some aspects of that, but that's another conversation. But it has got me to sit in Zoom meetings now and do trainings for people, how to protect yourself as much as possible, how to have a role in my very structured protests, and be able to do that and just get more people out on the streets, out in front of these clinics, out in front of these psychotherapy offices where these people are just on a train trying to get that money at the expense of the safeguarding of children and women. And now, you know, they went after, like I said, they went after my community first, the more masculine lesbians, and then they started just going after teenagers. And then the whole gender woo-woo comes around, right? And then some of those young effeminate gay boys start getting wrapped up in that. And now they're going after straight kids. And it doesn't matter what your sexuality is. It doesn't even matter if you've had any form of sexuality in your mind. If you're 4 years old and you're starting, you're a little boy and you want to wear a dress, you have a mother that's a Munchausen mind that wants to change that kid into a girl. All we have to do is see what's happened to Jazz Jennings. So I'll stop with my proselytizing around that. But when you ask me now, Beth, that is the woman, that is the lesbian that I've become. That is the kind of activist that when I thought before I die and while I'm on this planet, taking up air and room and creating a carbon footprint of some sort, I hope that my legacy is that I helped to save some lives. And this fight has been going on with me for more than 40 years at this point, even though I, quote, almost became a man. Almost. I was going that path, like I said. And thank goodness I had a girlfriend many, many years ago when I said, how would you feel if I did that? And she said, well, you know, we can't be together if you do that. And I thanked her. I thanked her years later after we were broken up. I wrote her a real nice email about that. And I couldn't believe that she wouldn't want to be with me. But that caused me to pause some more on top of feminism, on top of really recognizing I needed to learn to love my body. Thank goodness I ran into a butch psychotherapist who told me, you're not a man, you're never going to be a man. You're a beautiful, lovely soul, you know, butch woman. You got to learn how to embrace that.
You were very fortunate to get a butch therapist.
Yeah, well, again, we're talking way back. And meanwhile, the LGBT center and all this new money that we couldn't figure out at the time, right, back in the 90s, in the late 90s and the 2000s, it's like, what is going on? We knew money was coming from somewhere, but I did not realize exactly that they would go after kids. So I feel nothing but incredible responsibility to help stop that. And that's my battle. I'm sticking to it. And I formed a company called Can I Get a Witness? So now I can say I'm a business owner, but I put on a fantastic 13 and a half hour conference online last year called Can I Get a Witness that people from over 10 countries watched, 500 viewers. The average time was over 10 hours that people watched the damn thing. 27 presenters. Started it with Abigail Schreier, ended with Kira Bell, sandwiched in between with all kinds of beautiful people like Jennifer Billick and a lot of little known people.
Sounds like a great lineup.
It's fantastic. And that's another story, but that's the activism now involves joining hands with people I never thought I would. And if the one thing right now in this single issue that we can experience is trying to safeguard kids. That's where my heart is. The fact that I'm a lesbian and in that process, I can help some people that might be homophobic or used to be homophobic get their heads turned a little bit. That's all good as well. But I still carry with me a lot of my having to turn my head left to right, see what's around. That survival has never left me. And it has always caused me in this development of what I think we're maybe having these little stabs at trying to build a new women's movement. The lesbian visibility within that is just like it was when Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, and Bella Abzug were the elevated stars. Mm-hmm. We have our own people like that now, our own women. They're all straight.
Yep.
And they get to be elevated all the time.
Yes.
And I, within this struggle around the clinics and turning people, you know, towards activism and training people how to be, I'm working with others to build female leadership and trying to insist on lesbian voices being in those, in that leadership. Still a struggle. Most of the straight women that have the attention, they don't want to give it up and they don't want to share it.
Yeah.
And in the fall of 2021, that's incredibly discouraging. But we build the relationships where we can and we keep it going, because what's the option if it's not to fight?
Yes.
That's
absolutely.
It. We got to keep it up.
Well, I think we have probably gone over a little bit. But I want you to know how much I appreciate the conversation with you and your time, your precious time, because I know you're a very busy woman. I want to thank you for having come on Lesbian Echoes, and maybe we'll do this again sometime.
I really appreciate what you're doing, the work that you're doing. This is like kind of like the work of WLRN, Women's Liberation Radio News, where it's like time capsule, isn't it, Beth?
Yes.
Capturing these things, and that we have the technology now to do this. So I appreciate you very much.
Well, thanks again. And thank you to all our listeners. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this segment of Lesbian Echoes. Be sure to check in with us next time as we bring the stories of lesbians' lives to you.